This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
Ranked number one in innovation 10 consecutive years, Arizona State University isn't just ahead of the curve. It's creating new paths to success. Learn from notable clinical and research faculty. Online, that's a degree better. Explore programs at asuonline.asu.edu.
Saving money on your auto loan? It's never been easier. For a limited time, First United Credit Union can help you cruise into savings with rates as low as 4.99% APR when you refinance. Even better, you can enjoy no payments for 90 days. Use promo code CRUISE when you apply. Visit firstunitedcu.org/cruise to learn more. That's firstunitedcu.org/cruise. First United Credit Union, your local partner in banking.
BBC Sounds. Music, radio, podcasts.
You're about to listen to The Infinite Monkey Cage. Episodes will be released on Wednesdays, wherever you get your podcasts from. But if you're in the UK, the full series is available right now, first on BBC Sounds.
Hello, I'm Brian Cox.
And I'm Robin Ince.
And this is The Infinite Monkey Cage.
Now, Brian, as you can probably tell, is very much a natural ice skater, whereas I am so naturally clumsy. I have so much entropy that just seems to be around me all the time. Why is it that I slip over on ice a lot more than you do from, like, kind of the perspective of physics?
I reckon it's because your centre of mass is in the wrong place. Redshifted.
Redshifted. All right, then. Well, ice has, of course, is this is what we're going to talk about today, and ice has played a major part in not merely science, but also science variety. Does anyone here know about the Iceman?
Val Kilmer.
It's not Val Kilmer! No Top Gun, right? None of you heard about the Iceman. It's one of the greatest acts that ever used to be. A man would turn up to a comedy club with a block of ice, and his 20-minute routine was him trying to melt it before the time ran out, and then he would merely write down another failure and walk off with what remained of the ice.
Has anybody actually heard of that? No.
They're making a movie about him and everything.
But Iceman in Top Gun... Yeah.
Okay. So this is my first time here. Is this the show?
Very unusually, Robin's rambling introduction is germane to today's show, because today we're talking about ice. At first sight, perhaps the simplest of substances, yet arguably the most complex crystalline solid known to exist in nature.
To explore the wonder of ice, we are joined by an icebreaker, an ice shaker, an ice gyrator, and an ice explorer, which really ruined the alliteration of the first three, unfortunately. And they are...
My name's Felicity Aston, and I'm the polar explorer that ruined your introduction, sorry. But I also do a bit of science. I look at airborne microplastics across the Arctic at the University of Southampton and the National Oceanography Centre, which is also in Southampton. And my most embarrassing story about ice, I can't believe I'm going to tell this story on a radio program, but it's about something called the Poosicle, which I was posted, I know, I've ruined the highbrow already, haven't I? But I was posted down in Antarctica with the British Antarctic Survey, and quite early on, I was sent to a place called Sky Blue, which is an area where the snow has been scoured off of the ice to leave this streak of lovely blue ice that they use as a runway for planes. So I was sent there as a meteorologist to do weather for the planes, and there were a few guys there who'd been there a while, and the conditions were pretty basic. And the toilet was a big, bright orange pyramid tent, tall enough to stand up in. And the toilet was just a big, deep hole dug into the ice with a bit of plywood around the outside so you didn't fall in it. And the guys were talking about, oh, is the broom in the toilet tent? And there was a lot of fuss about the broom. Is the broom? I thought, that's nice. They're keeping it tidy. Hygiene, it's important. And but it didn't take me long before I realised when I went to the toilet tent, there's this big hole, and there's this broom, and it's a wooden broom, but all the bristles have been chopped off it. So now I'm really confused. But if you can imagine the practicality of, you know, positioning yourself over a hole to do your business, and everybody's doing their business in the same place, and of course anything that goes into the long drop freezes because it's in ice. So eventually you get a sort of stalagmite of poo that surprisingly quickly sort of emerges above the surface And it becomes impossible to position yourself around this structure. So that's where the broomstick comes in. You suddenly realise, oh, light bulb moment, that's what the broomstick is for. It's to do battle with the poosicle so that you can do the necessary in the long drop. So that's my most embarrassing story.
Follow that, Christoph.
Hi, everyone. My name is Professor Christoph Salzmann. It's funny that you mentioned Iceman because my surname is Salzmann, but lots of colleagues, and I only found out recently, call me Professor Iceman behind my back. I mean, I guess it could be worse, right? But anyway.
And he does look exactly like Val Kilmer, listeners.
There you go, yeah. Yeah, so I'm probably best known for having discovered ICE 13, ICE 14, and ICE 15. On the embarrassing side, though, despite being a well-known ICE researcher, I'm really embarrassed to admit that I broke my leg a couple of years ago during ice skating.
Well, my name's Liz Morris. I'm an emeritus associate at the Scott Polar Research Institute, which is in Cambridge, and I've spent most of my life working on snow and ice in various ways, mostly in the polar regions, both Greenland and in Antarctica, and lately have been much concerned with the effect of climate change on the snow and ice there. I suppose I have to admit my most embarrassing moment, I think, came when I first set foot in Antarctica, which was after a considerable struggle that had gone on for about 20 years. So it was a very, very big and emotional moment for me when I first landed on Cygni Island and got out of the boat and set foot on the promised land at last. And I thought perhaps there ought to be a photograph of this historic moment and asked a friend. So stood there posing, trying to look a bit noble, a bit intrepid, maybe trying to look a bit like Felicity, though I didn't know Felicity at the time, or maybe even a bit like Brian Cox, although he hadn't been invented at the time.
I'm glad you knew he was invented.
Anyway, there I was standing there composing myself when up came a smaller daily penguin and pecked me in the knee. So I fell over and was flat on my back like a beetle upside down, waving my arms and legs in the air and unable to get up. And that was the first moment that I set foot in Antarctica.
Hello, I'm Darren, comedian and radio show host. My most embarrassing moment on ice was I did a TV show 2 years ago called Dancing on Ice. That's not the most embarrassing part. I had to do a routine where I was sort of skating and I had to rip my trousers off to reveal a pair of really tight golden pants. They went off without a hitch. I finished the routine and while I'm on the ice, this guy comes up to me and he goes, "Oh, those gold pants, I remember those. I think I wore those when I did I'm a Celeb." That person was Matt Hancock.
And this is our panel.
I thought we should start with the definition. And we made a film recently about ice worlds in the solar system. And we asked several experts for a definition of ice, and there was no consensus. So I thought I would start by asking the question to each member of the panel, what is ice?
Let's start with you, Christoph, then. And then
ice is the solid form of water, right?
But what about nitrogen ice or carbon dioxide ice? So what is an ice?
That's right. So in astronomy and the space scientists use the term ice quite loosely.
Call frozen nitrogen. Would you call it nitrogen ice?
Nitrogen ice, yeah. Or if it's CO2, you'd call it dry ice. But I would argue there is only one type of ice, and that's the ice you get when you put water into a freezer.
So, Felicity, what do we reckon?
Well, I've come across all sorts of ice. So I've travelled across glacier ice, sea ice, river ice, lake ice. But very rarely does the ice I deal with come out of a freezer or being artificially frozen. You know, and it's amazing how different the characteristics of ice is. I mean, just between the Arctic and the Antarctic, a lot of people think of those two places as big, white, cold places that are largely the same. But they are so different to the point of if you plonked me down on some sea ice and I didn't know where I was and said, are you in the Arctic or Antarctic? Pretty quickly, I'd have a good go at being able to tell you accurately which end of the planet I was on, because the geography is so different. And so the formation of the ice is different, the behavior of it, the look of it, the feel of it is different. If you look at the history of European exploration of the Arctic, it is just a litany of imaginative ways, gruesome, horrible, lingering, long ways to die horribly on ice. I mean, ice can kill you in so many ways. Yeah, so my defining characteristic is it's something cold and dangerous.
Could you defend the honour of ice?
I'm definitely going to defend the honour of ice. My first contact with ice was in the form of snow in 1947, when I was just able to walk in it. I thought it was utterly wonderful, absolutely beautiful, and I've never, ever not wanted to be in snow. And of course I agree with Christoph, it is only the solid form of water. But the ways in which this material can build into different structures, everything from a huge iceberg to the tiniest and most beautiful of snowflakes, is utterly fascinating. And it does have some properties that are almost unique in the world. And our world would be totally different, for example, if ice didn't float on water, which is probably about the most mysterious thing that you can think of.
We thought we'd demonstrate that, actually. We don't usually do experiments.
And so we got this gin. And we got this tonic. So we are going to do that experiment.
Can I ask a question
about
alcohol? What is it in alcohol that makes it not freeze? Vodka?
It freezes if you get it cold enough. I've had a bottle of vodka in Antarctica at minus 50, and it froze.
So, Darren, what about your definition of ice then?
My definition is exactly what Christoph said. It's just frozen water. But then I got thinking, about one of my favourite movies is a film called Demolition Man. And they freeze people and then they bring them back in the future to fight crime. And I was like, if you freeze a person, like completely freeze them, do we class that as like ice?
No.
No.
That's a frozen person.
This is going to be a long show for me. So what do you class a frozen, completely frozen person? They're in a block of ice. They're not ice. Why am I being combative? What do we call, what do we call that?
Oh, you could call it dirty ice.
I really like the way you said that. All right, dirty ice.
So yeah. I love the idea of, frozen person is just ice with impurities in it to you. Whilst Robin prepares the gin and tonics, it's worth doing this at home, actually, or at least floating some ice cubes on the liquid, because I'd like to explore, Christoph, to go right to the most basic level. Could you describe what it is about the way that water molecules bond together in ice that produces these strange properties?
Water is a really special molecule, right? And it's actually quite a small molecule that forms bonds with other water molecules at quite long distances, and that's called hydrogen bonding. And at the end of the day, all the properties that we can discuss about water and ice, it all comes down to the hydrogen bonding, so to the way the water molecules interact with one another. So water is obviously H2O, right? And you can form an interaction that sort of goes from an oxygen to a hydrogen and then to another oxygen. That's a hydrogen bonding. There's an analogy. You could think of ice forming as a massive game of Twister, like the party game, but the rule is that everybody grabs two other people by their ankles. That's forming the hydrogen bonds. And of course, as you grab the other people, somebody else will grab you at your ankle as well. And that's basically how you build up a hydrogen bonded network. And that's basically what happens when water freezes.
And why is it so unusual as a solid, this property that it floats on its own liquid? That's pretty much unique, isn't it?
There are other materials as well, but it comes down to the fact that water is quite a small molecule, but it forms these rather long hydrogen bonds. So when it crystallizes, it keeps the neighbors a little bit further apart than it would be in the liquid. So within the liquid, water molecules can approach closer to one another and being not hydrogen bonded, and that's simply denser now. But I also need to say something. it's only really the ice 1 that floats on liquid water. Of course, we know up to ice 20 now, and none of the others float on water. So it's really, the curiosity is really, really the case of ice 1.
We should come back to that in a moment. But Liz, you mentioned that that property of ice is extremely important for us. This simple thing that we you might be observing it now, if you have poured out a drink at home and you've got the ice cubes in it, it is worth focusing on the fact they're floating. Why is that so important?
Well, I think for the environment, you think, for example, of sea ice, which is frozen seawater at the poles in the Arctic and Antarctic, is floating on the surface of the water. It's not sinking down. So as soon as you have the sea ice, which is pretty well white, you have a reflective layer, which means that the heat coming into the ocean is turned back, the sun's rays. So immediately you have a situation where you've set up a temperature gradient around the globe, which is driving quite a lot of the weather and the climate of the globe. If the sea ice sank to the bottom of the ocean, the surface of the ocean wouldn't change, it would still be dark, and you'd still get the same amount of heat coming in. So that's one way. The same sort of thing happens in lakes. You freeze the top of a lake, and then that actually protects the rest of the lake, and fish can live in the rest of the lake during the winter.
And we wouldn't be here even. So if ice would sink, the oceans would have frozen up from the bottom, and evolution may have never happened, right?
You mentioned this. It's rather cryptic, perhaps, to many people. You said it's only ice 1.
Yeah.
And you mentioned you discovered 3 of the...
I found number 13, 14 and 15.
13, 14 and 15. Because it will be surprising to many. There are different forms of ice.
Yeah.
Why?
Well, the various different forms of ice, just the water molecules, they pack differently with respect to one another. And obviously, as you go to higher pressures, they will pack more efficiently. And then you get these high-density phases of ice, which you find in the solar system, actually. And you actually find some of them on Earth as well. So there's some... There's some diamonds, and obviously diamonds form under enormous pressure. And when a diamond forms and there's a bit of water inside the diamond, it will be ice 7, for example. And
due to the way we experience the world, we think of it as in one way. And this idea of actually going, Felicity, that this is, well, no, there's ice 1, ice 2, ice 3, ice 4, ice 5. Yeah. You know, that is, how far up do we go with the ices, first of all?
I mean, it makes a lot of sense. I mean, a lot of the ice that I come across in the Arctic, in the Antarctic, glacier ice, for example, it's been under huge amounts of pressure for a very long time. So you get ice that's different colour. The different colours and shades of blues and purples and pinks that you can get in different densities of ice are, you know, unbelievable to see. It's absolutely spellbinding. And you can tell by the colour of the ice roughly how old it is. You know, the older the ice, it's sort of blue because it's had a lot of the air pressed out of it because it's been at the bottom of a glacier or something like that. And if you take some of that really old ice and put it into your gin and tonic, it's very explosive because those tiny little air bubbles that are left inside the ice are suddenly released with this mini explosion. So it's interesting to put it in your drink.
I mean, while we're on the subject of ice bubbles, I don't know whether people know, but there's been a very, very big and exciting ice core drilling project going on in the Antarctic called Beyond Epica, and they have just managed to reach bedrock at 2,800 meters below the surface. So that's a really long ice core. And at the bottom of this ice core, we have information from the period, so more than a million years ago. And that information comes from the bubbles that Felicity was talking about in the ice. If you extract the air from that, that is the air, and we get the chemical composition of the air that was that old. And we can see, for example, what carbon dioxide levels were like then. And we also know what the temperatures were like there. So we can start looking at the change in the ice ages back and forth, cold and warm, going back over a million years.
Well, we're on the basic properties of ice. So the fact that it's slippery... So that's an unusual thing if you think about it for a solid. It's extremely slippery. Why?
There is this layer of sort of a thin layer of liquid water on top of the ice. People call it the quasi-liquid layer. So the way to imagine is, you know, you have a crystal and all these water molecules, and basically everybody wants to be on the inside. Nobody wants to be at the surface. So in a sense, they're all struggling to get back into the bulk of the crystal. And that means they are more mobile. And the water molecules being more mobile at the surface just means we can skate on ice.
And can you skate on ice? I mean, what heat did you get through to, Darren? Let's find out that.
I think I lasted eight weeks. I didn't. Yeah, you never trust ice at all. Like we'd just be standing on the ice, just chatting, and then one of them, and then they'd freeze, and then you'd start laughing, and that was it throughout. Yeah, you just honestly, even when there's like ice outside on the pet, I get so nervous, I get so scared. But that was because of that show. You're voluntarily going on ice, and that's why I'm hearing you talk about how much you love ice and snow, and I'm sitting here going, what is going on? Like, do you make snowmen?
Yeah.
There are some places where it's impossible to make a snowman. So if you get really close to the South Pole area of Antarctica, the snow gets so dry that it won't actually stick together. So if you've got a handful and try to make a snowball, it just remains...
You can't even make a snowman.
You can't make a snowman. It's impossible.
What?
Yeah.
So is that what makes it sort of stick to you? Sometimes you've got ice that really sticks to your hand.
The temperature needs to be right. Yeah, if the temperature is too low, it won't be sticky anymore. If the temperature is too high, it's not good for skating either, because then the skates, they have to plow through this liquid layer. So it's like just the perfect temperature, which is, I think, at -7 degrees Celsius, which is just the perfect temperature for ice skating.
But there's a show that they should do that'd be better than skating on ice. And that is trying to move across very thin ice. Like ice, when it's just started to form, and you've got this tiny, it's not even
Matt Hancock.
A centimetre thin.
Yeah.
But it really sort of bends and stretches. So we used to, again, there's not much to do when you're on an Antarctic research station in the winter, right? So you've got the ice starting to form. And so we used to put on these dry suits and have a race over thin ice. And you'd try and sort of spread your weight out onto the ice. And you would watch people as they're sort of pulling themselves across the surface of the ice, that the ice would be bowing underneath them. And it's incredibly elastic. And it would take a while before someone would do something like putting their weight too much on one hand or one foot and they'd fall through, and then it's impossible to get back up onto the ice. But then...
Percentage-wise, how many go out and how many come back in terms of...
The joy on your face as you said that as well.
Yeah. Suggested it was never you that fell in. Yeah.
The ice didn't have to get very thick. I remember clearly there was a chart by my desk, because I was there as a meteorologist. And so one of the charts that I had behind the Met desk was ice thickness and things that you could do on ice when it got to different thicknesses. And I remember clearly that it said that you were able to land a plane on ice when it was 30 centimetres thick. Now, I cannot believe that to be true. I've never tested it in any way to know, but that just boggled my mind.
That sounds like a Ryanair thing.
Christoph, in terms of material, Christoph, that as you said, it does sound rather thin to support an aircraft. Is it a strong material as materials go?
Yeah, it's a strong material. I mean, it is also quite soft. Glaciers flow, right? It's forgiving with respect to defects.
Yeah, I wanted to talk about that actually. The glaciers. So could you describe? Because I suppose you tend to think of them as just solid blocks of ice, but as you said, that they flow, they're dynamic. Could you give us a picture of a glacier?
Yeah, I suppose it's the best analogy is of a molten metal. Ice is actually, in the normal environment, it's very close to its melting point. So if you think of it like that, it's a material which is quite stiff, but it does flow, and it also has another property, which is that when it comes up against a bump on the bed of that it's flowing down, it can actually melt on one side of the bump because of the pressure it exerts. And then that melt water can refreeze on the downstream side of the bump. So it's got another method of moving downhill, which is basal sliding because of what we call regulation.
Well, and that property, that if anyone's listening is doing, I suppose, GCSE or A-level chemistry, the idea that you put a solid under pressure and it melts is an unusual property.
It is, and Christoph will just say, well, you know, this is, we're talking about ice one here, not a fancy one. But
so all the other ices, the melting point actually would go up as you increase in pressure. It's really just the ice one that's the odd one out.
And why is that surprising, that you put it under pressure and it melts?
I mean, it comes down to an equation in thermodynamics, but it comes down to the fact that it floats on water. That's the reason why it melts at lower temperatures as you squeeze it a little bit. But you only go around to 2,000 atmospheres and then the trend is reversed. Then the melting point starts going up. And if you go to around 20,000 atmosphere, you reach room temperature. So you have ice at room temperature. You go even higher, you can have ice at hundreds of degrees. So in like some of the gas giants like Uranus, you'd have ice maybe at 5,000 degrees.
You said only 2,000 atmospheres. And then the behaviour reverses. I mean, and only 20,000 atmospheres and the temperature is room temperature.
Yeah, I mean, 2,000 atmospheres is what we do easily in our lab, right? I mean, that's easily achieved. I mean, the pressure changes dramatically, you know.
Felicity, what about, you know, when you are exploring, when you're going out there, what are the factors you are having to take into account, and indeed the factors that are taken into account when someone goes, right, we have to make the most effective icebreaker?
If you're out on sea ice at a high latitude north, so in the middle of the Arctic Ocean somewhere, the ice breaks open because it's constantly moving. You know, there's not solid land under your feet. You're walking across an ocean. So it's just a very relatively thin skin of ice on the top. And it's constantly being moved around by the ocean currents underneath it and the atmosphere above it. So it gets pushed together and it gets pulled apart. And in places where it gets pulled apart to reveal the water underneath, it steams because the air temperature might be something like minus 20, minus 40, but the seawater doesn't get colder than maybe, I don't know, a couple of degrees below zero, something like that. So it's much hotter than the air above it. So when you're traveling across sea ice in the Arctic, the first sign of trouble of there being open water up ahead, which is your absolute nemesis if you are a polar skier trying to get across an area of sea ice, is if you start to see what feels like mist or fog up ahead, then you know that means there's open water up there and you want to avoid it at all costs. The whole time that you're traveling through ice, and it doesn't matter whether it's a glacier or whether it's sea ice, you have to learn how to pick up on the cues that you're seeing around you in that environment.
And the open water, so the prevalence of open water. So I think you mentioned that the North Pole now is pretty much inaccessible.
Perhaps it's easier to go back to the first time someone indisputably went from solid land to the North Pole across the surface of the Arctic Ocean was Sir Wally Herbert, who did it in 1969, 9th of April. Mm. And the reason why that wasn't hailed as the great achievement that it indisputably was is because just a few months later, Neil Armstrong made the step for mankind onto the moon. So we almost reached another planetary body before we got to the very top of our own. I mean, I think that speaks volumes about how difficult this environment is to survive.
What kind of sounds are you hearing out there?
Yeah, sound is really different, but it's more about the temperature that you're in. So in the extreme cold, if you're walking through snow, for example, snow gets much squeakier depending on how cold you are. So if you're down below minus 40, it sounds like you're walking on polystyrene, that kind of thing. Yeah. Whereas if it's warmer, then it sounds different.
Mm. Now do the sound. You can't just do the sound for one.
There we go.
That's much better.
Is it the case that now it's probably not possible to repeat that feat to the North Pole?
I think the problem is there's so much open water and it's so difficult to even get onto the ice from the land and do it properly, you know, not just be put in by an aircraft, that I think it's just not feasible to do an overland crossing.
A good colleague of mine put it, as explorers, we're not chasing firsts anymore, we're chasing lasts. Yeah. The last time somebody went on skis from land to the North Pole was in 2014.
Yeah. Probably within the next 20 to 30 years, it will be a navigation route for very big container ships.
Yet another way the ice will kill you, get run over by some...
I didn't think you actually meant traffic. I thought it was just a traffic.
I mean, traffic like in the English Channel. You know?
But this is, of course, the primary difference between the two poles, right? There's no land up there at the North Pole. It's just, we just think of it as solid because in most of our lifetimes it's been frozen. Yeah. But it won't be in a few decades' time. It'll just be an ocean.
Yeah, that's right.
Whereas Antarctica?
Antarctica is a land continent, although... It's a bit deceptive because although at the moment you look at it and it's a great dome of ice, you know, thousands of metres thick. In fact, we've done enough of surveying of the underlying rock to realise it's in fact quite a lot of it is sitting on islands and is sitting on something which is below sea level. So once the Antarctic ice sheet in the western part starts to lose mass, it could lift off from the seabed. And then we'll sort of have a situation where instead of being constrained by the mountains and valleys underneath it, it's just floating and can float off. So, in fact, when you try to do sums about how soon it might be before we lost the Antarctic, it's very difficult to do because, in fact, things could happen a lot faster than just simple calculations about how long to melt that mass of ice.
Although people may not care that explorers can't plant their flag at the North Pole anymore, you know, the importance of the story is that it really illustrates how quick, how rapid this change has been. And that's the big message about climate change. These changes are being on such a large scale and in such a short period of time. How can the rest of the ecosystem catch up with that? And that's why people are really concerned, particularly about the Arctic, which is changing at a rate... three times faster than anywhere else in the world. So, you know, you're really visibly seeing it.
Can I just add to this fun section of our chat that people who believe the Earth is flat, they think it's ice. That's the reason why we don't fall off the Earth. Just wanted to let you know the sort of friends I have.
is that in for balance? Yeah. Christoph, we've talked about ice one. In some detail.
Oh, we're not going to do all 20, are we? No, we'll be there for hours.
But you discovered three, as you mentioned. So can you describe those three that you discovered?
I mean, they're obviously very special to my heart, right? Because I found them one day. I was working in the lab, you know, changing pressure and temperature. And then, you know, I suddenly made these new forms of ice. And then there was a bit of a disappointment after that, actually, because I tried to reproduce it the next day and I couldn't anymore, right? And that's where my frustration set in. And then it turned out, actually, in hindsight, it took me quite some time to figure this out. And it just turned out on that day when I made ice 13, someone messed with the water supply at the department and they mixed in a bit of acid, right? And that little bit of acid did the trick which allowed me to discover ice 13, but I did not know there was any acid, right? So only months later, I thought, you know, why don't I just add a little bit of acid to water and then I could make it, and I could make it even much better than before. You know?
I had a similar experience over Christmas. I made a brand new cocktail called a Mojito Rita, unknown to man, and the next day couldn't remember how I made it.
You looked at these different forms of ice. What would they look like? Would any be obviously different, or do you have to do crystallography to discern the structure?
So most of them are white, right? It needs to be said. You need to do crystallography to really figure out the differences. However, the ice 18 and the ice 20, they are quite exciting because people think they would actually be black.
Hmm? Oh, really?
Because they are so-called super ionic forms of ice. So what happens in those is that, I mean, the water molecules are H2O molecules, and the hydrogens are typically bonded quite strongly to the oxygen, but in superionic forms, the oxygens say goodbye to the hydrogens, and they just float away. So like electrons would in a metal, and that's when you get black ice, as they call it.
I think there's a theory, isn't there, that they may play a role in the ice giants, like Uranus and Neptune.
Absolutely,
in
yeah.
the atmospheres.
Yeah. Because they are conducting and it has an impact on the magnetic field of Uranus, for example. Yeah.
Yeah.
And the discovery is quite significant because it turns out that the melting point of ice is even higher in temperature than we previously appreciated, because the ice can go superionic. So that's a form, that's a way for the ice to pick up some additional entropy, right? We spoke about entropy earlier. And picking up entropy means we're shifting up the melting point even further. So we are really talking thousands of degrees in terms of melting point for the ice 20, for example.
Under what pressure would that be then?
That's hundreds of gigapascals, right? Okay, let me...
right, so it's 100,000 million atmospheres.
Exactly, yes.
Like that, right?
Yeah. These pressures are very hard to achieve on Earth, and they have been done with laser pulses. So you just need an incredibly powerful laser source.
This is great, Darren, isn't it? This is James Bond stuff, isn't it? Bond villain.
I'm sitting here smiling going, I love Ice 20. Yeah.
I didn't know about all these different types of ice.
Do you think there could be more? Or do you think...
Absolutely, yeah. Yeah. There's got to be a much larger number. So there's a group, they do computer calculations, and they've predicted how many forms there could be, and I think they were up to 19,000 different forms of ice.
19?
So,
yeah.
It kind of loses its being as special.
I guess, yeah.
But isn't it astonishing? It astonishes me from this simple molecule. What do you say? Was it 90,000?
But the
different ways of arranging.
Yeah, but the simplicity is key, right? Because if it's a simple molecule, there's just lots and lots of different ways how you can pack it. So that's really key. It comes down to the simplicity at the end of the day. That opens up the complexity, if that makes sense.
Yeah. Liz, I'm going to ask you just a little bit about, because we've talked before, we're nearly out of time, but about also, you know, the sensory experience of, like, you talked about your first sensory experience was falling over after being attacked by a penguin. But after that, the fact that when you are in that environment, your experience of what you see and what is available to you is different to what we are seeing out here now.
I think there's a sort of a romantic sort of connection to the purity of it and the simplicity of it. I think in my case, I was very glad to be in what I felt was a very simple world in which I had none of the difficulties of everyday life. I was just going out into the Antarctic. I had my tent. There were, you know, two skidoos, three sledges full of food and fuel and scientific equipment. I had my companion, and it was go. And there was nothing else that we had to worry about. So for me, the ice and snow of the Antarctic is associated with complete freedom. And also with a simple task. I mean, it was a difficult task many times because you were trying to do things with frozen hands, frozen feet. You were trying to make quite difficult measurements. You know, the computer started to fuss about because it was at minus 40 and it didn't like it. You know, and the generator wouldn't start if it was below minus 28 and all these other little problems. But compared...
It's not a little problem, is it? The generator won't start.
But for me, you know, I have to say, just in case there's anybody out there in the rather dark audience who's dreaming about being a scientist in the Antarctic, go for it. It's the most wonderful experience. And being a physicist, I'm going to put in a plug for being a physicist now. It's the best possible preparation, the best possible career you could have for looking at the environment. And, you know, I just felt all the time I was doing what I was born to do.
And by the way, Liz is a total pioneer. You know, you are my hero, Liz, because you blaze such a trail, particularly for women, that you're amazing. But when you're out in these landscapes and you're seeing the true forces of nature unrestricted, you know, you're seeing blocks of ice the size of apartments being thrown around, and you're seeing crevasses opening up and ice moving. It really does give you a whole new perspective, and I think that's why a lot of people, when they go into the polar environments, find it quite a spiritual experience, because it changes your perspective. You're looking at different scales of things.
Yeah. I think I had a friend once who remarked of somebody who was making a bit of fuss about life that what they really needed was a bad twin otter landing. And I think I think that is true. I think, you know, if you've been absolutely scared out of your mind, it does reset things quite a lot.
especially if you go, God, that landing was absolutely terrifying. I'm going to go to the loo. Oh, God, the poosicle's really high. Can't believe no one's cleared the poosicle.
Before you even get to the golden pants, right?
Do we need to go straight to, are we out of time?
I don't want to draw this to a close, actually.
No, we haven't talked about the noise of the ice as well.
Well, we could just meet.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah, let's just talk about that.
I think the one thing you don't want to hear is a crack, a sudden crack, because that usually means trouble. What is very, very nice is to be lying in a pyramid tent with the swish of the ice crystals blowing against the canvas of the tent, and to know that you're snug and warm, and whatever else is going on outside, you've got it sorted, and you know you've got a nice bowl of, munch, we call it, inside you. You're warm, you're dry, and all is well with the world. And you just hear this swish of the ice crystals coming against the tent. That's the best sound ever. The diamond dust coming down, and the, you know, the beautiful smooth surface, and the sledge running beautifully over the surface, and enjoy it.
And then the penguin turns up, you go, not again. How do you feel about Darren Hepto? If someone comes to you going, we're going to do a new version of, skating on ice, whatever it's going to be called, and they're going to do it on very, very thin ice, which is entirely trustworthy from a scientific perspective. Are we going to see you on that particular show?
Yeah, I like the idea of that, actually. Me and Matt Hancock just hanging out. One leg in either pant. I don't know why I said that. That was weird.
I don't know why you said that.
Two men, one pair of pants. Antarctic. I can see it.
Right. Thank you so much. We asked the audience a question as well. And we asked them, who would they most like to cryopreserve and why? What you got there, Darren?
Okay. Prince Andrew.
Oh.
To check on his sweat glands.
Next one.
My bank account. If it's been frozen, it'll explain why the balance never goes up.
And Andy Jones makes a very good point. So it's what would you most like to discover encased in ice? The Arctic.
Yeah, yeah. That's very good. Thank you, Anna.
Yeah.
My ex-husband, so I can leave him there.
Who or what would you like to discover encased in ice? An ice cube, ultimate hiding place.
Yes. Very good.
But it's see-through.
Not if it's super ionic ice.
Oh, the black ice.
It could be encased in super ionic ice. Be super ionic ice, though, wouldn't it? It wouldn't be an ice cube.
What have we got here? A heater, because things can only get wetter. Oh. Well done. We always wait for one of those. So, thank you so much to our panel, Liz Morris, Christoph Saltzman, Darren Harriott, and Felicity Aston. Next week, I am very excited because, as some of you might know, we are big fans of wrestling. And in previous shows, we have done such wrestling specials as bats versus flies and cats versus dogs. But we feel we've been getting too small. So next week, we are going to have a battle of the planets where two gas giants take each other on. We are seeing Saturn versus Jupiter. Brian, which one do you think is going to win?
Jupiter.
No, I don't think it will, because I think the hula hoop of Saturn will be used in some kind of way.
Thanks very much for listening,
and I hope you've enjoyed yourself.
Turn that nice again.
Strong message here from BBC Radio 4.
I'm Amanda Iannucci.
And I'm Helen Lewis.
A comedy writer and a journalist teaming up like a pair of unkempt and unlikely superheroes.
Our mission is to decipher political language.
Stress testing to destruction those used and abused buzzwords and phrases.
Finding out what they really mean.
And looking at whether they're meant to deceive us.
Or to distract us.
Or to disturb us.
And our pledge is to help you spot the tricks of the verbal trade.
But be warned, this series does feature strong political language that some listeners may find an inverted pyramid of piffle.
Strong message here from BBC Radio 4.
Listen now on BBC Sound.